Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Alicia Green, Susan Demas, and Emily Jane Lawler. John Rurink was here just a minute ago, but we were too slow in getting off the dime, and he had to leave. But don't worry, the spirit of John will live on because he's got a nomination for Freshman of the Year, something new that we're doing here at MERS, where we're going to recognize the freshman legislator who's had, in our view, the most impact, has been the most effective, and the most active in their first year in the legislature. We're going to do those nominations in a little bit. But first, Alicia, let's talk about some stuff that's going on in the House. One of the more interesting things that happened last week was this debate on the floor about adding Court of Appeals judges. We're not adding, but we're keeping the same number, and that's different than what Governor Snyder is wanted all along.
Right. So on the floor, the Republicans decided to go with a bill that would keep the current level of Court of Appeals judges at 28. That goes against the recommendations from the Judicial Resources Recommendations Report, which Governor Snyder, the Supreme Court, and basically every judges association had supported. So that caused a little bit of surprise. The Democrats railed against it, saying that it would cost us more money, and chaos ensued for a little while.
Now, we did have some Democrats who were upset because they feel like there's politics being played here, because if the Republicans can keep the number of Court of Appeal judges where they are, then conceivably we can have more Republicans on the court. But if Snyder doesn't want to appoint them, then what's the point?
That's a good question. I think it will be interesting to see if this bill becomes a second veto.
Well, we're going to keep our eyes on that. And then meanwhile, at the Senate, where we had a four-hour bill reading, we had some other issues going on with a bill that was introduced on restricting the amount of recall that we can have in this state. And after what we saw this past summer, Susan, what's the future like for a bill or some type of constitutional amendment that will restrict recalls in the state to malfeasance and misfeasance?
Right. Arlen Meekhoff introduced a constitutional amendment that would limit the reasons for recall, for basically your Kwame Kilpatricks. You'd need two-thirds majority in both houses for that to pass, and then it would take a vote of the people. So, and that's taken some big action. I don't know. I mean, I think you could probably get support for that, but a constitutional amendment is obviously a much bigger change than just doing it statutorily.
And I thought one thing that was interesting, Secretary of State Ruth Johnson is not in support of this legislation because she doesn't like any restrictions on the people's right to go to the ballot box and their right to vote or to express their displeasure, which I thought was interesting. And Dave Robertson, also the chair of the committee that will get this bill, is also not about ready to just ram it forward. Why do you think there is some hesitancy despite what we just saw?
I wonder if Tea Party groups might not like this because, you know, they like having this tool in their arsenal. So I'm wondering if they're getting some feedback from those folks. The Johnson argument is interesting because, of course, if this goes through, it would be through a vote of the people. So people would be okaying a restriction on their own voting rights. So,
well, that is an interesting thought.
It's kind of like a riddle within a sphinx.
Ooh, man, my brain hurts. That's a good question.
It's Monday morning.
Yeah, I know it. Man, that's some deep thought. Let's turn the page to something that doesn't require a lot of deep thought, and that's the end of the candidacy of Herman Cain. I did light a candle yesterday in honor of Herman Cain's candidacy, and I think the question then that now unfortunately has to happen, and let me just preface this by saying that it's not that I have a partiality to Herman Cain, it's just I hate it when the gang breaks up. I like having choices on ballots, and I think the more choices on ballots the better, because I hate having situations where we have all these different states casting votes in primaries after the primary has already been decided. And I always think that's very sad. I'd like to see everybody in every race all the way to the end so everybody gets to vote. I know it's a ridiculous thought to ever see in reality. But, Susan, what happens now? Who gets Herman Cain's support?
That's a good question. I mean, right now you've got the Gingrich surge. I don't know how much longer that can last because, you know, Newt has his own issues from women, or, you know, with women, as we know. So, but that might not affect him because, you know, Kane didn't exactly have a lot of female support. So, you know, it'd be a matter of where the men want to go.
Well, and, you know, the stuff with Kane just seemed to just pop out of nowhere. It was like something new. And but Gingrich, everybody's well known about his wives and, you know, they seem to have maybe put it behind him. It's kind of old news. I mean, is there anything new to come out on any of that?
I don't know of anything. I'm not going to break any news here. So, yeah, perhaps, you know, I mean, we all need forgiveness. So maybe there's a way for evangelicals to support him.
Or maybe they go with Rick Santorum.
I know he's the guy that you want to see some momentum for next. So, you know, it could happen. I'm kind of hoping that we see a Ron Paul surge.
I just wish you hadn't asked me to Google Rick Santorum's name. I just wish that that never happened.
Another Monday morning topic.
All right. Anyway, let's move on to one of the more. This is something I've wanted to do since I've been at MERS because I think that what we see in the legislature is some folks that stand out every year. They get behind some initiatives or they get behind some work that they're really passionate about. And I don't know if there's a lot of recognition sometimes. I mean, I know special interest groups have their legislators of the year, you know, but it's kind of a special topic. You know, it's not for overall excellence and you don't really get a comprehensive look as to who kind of did the best over the course of a year. And so what I'd like to do with this podcast, and this is completely subjective, but your views on who the most effective legislator was for the year. And so what I'm going to do is we're going to break this down into different segments because we've got four more editions left until the end of the year. This week we're going to do the most effective freshman. And then next week we're going to do the most effective Democrat because unfortunately there's kind of have to be two tiers since they are in the minority. It's going to be a little difficult for them to get stuff passed. And then we're going to do most effective senator. And then the last podcast of the year we're going to do the most effective House member of the year. This week we're going to do the most effective freshman. And I know, Susan, you wanted to nominate Judd Gilbert, but unfortunately Judd Gilbert is not a freshman. In fact, he's the most experienced member in the House, even though he just got elected. But anyway, we're not going to go into that. Let's go around the table. Let's nominate our most effective freshman of the year. Alicia, you're sitting directly to my right, so you get to go first.
All right, well, I have to go with Representative Jim Ananick because he has been active on unemployment, mortgage fraud, doing the sales tax on online sales. I mean, he's really been there for a ton of issues, very active. I know those were some of the criteria we talked about, you know, having impact, being active, being effective. So he's actually done a lot of bipartisan things this year as well, and I think we'll see more from him.
All right, we'll start with a Democrat. Susan, who's your nominee?
I'm going to go with a Republican, Representative Frank Foster. He's got a big fan club because of the work that he's done on feral swine and the Hunter Heritage Bill. So he's made a big impact with a lot of people.
Well, and not only that, he's one of the few freshmen who's chairing a committee, which, you know, by itself is a pretty big accomplishment. I mean, there's not a lot of freshmen who are chairing committees.
This is true.
Yeah. All right. Emily Lawley, your nominee for Freshman of the Year.
I'm going with Jeff Farrington because he pushed through the Administrative Procedures Act, first veto, only veto so far. And although it was vetoed, which I suppose would be an argument against effective, I think his heart was in the right place. I mean, there are some state agencies that have taken on a larger role than I guess maybe was intended, or maybe people are saying that they've overstepped their bounds. And he was trying to cut down on the bureaucracy and got enough votes for it and unfortunately didn't get the top vote. But, you know, I think he pushed that through with a lot of effort and goodwill.
My nominee for Freshman of the Year is going to be Alf Shulka. And first of all, I'm just happy that I got his name pronounced right finally. It took me almost a year to get that right. But I think Alf Shulka really is the Freshman of the Year in the legislature. I mean, this was a guy who took on this emergency manager legislation at the beginning of the year. And even though it was unpopular in his district of Benton Harbor, which includes Benton Harbor, he was able to get this through extremely quickly through the legislature. And if you look at the legislation itself, he was the only person who was able to get his name on there, and then nobody else co-signed it. If you look at it, there was no other co-sponsors to that EM legislation. It was only his. He took all the slings and arrows for it. He was the first legislator who got up for recall and effectively was the first one who was able to shoot it down as well. I think he's been rewarded for his effectiveness on that by getting appointed to more committees and is getting more looks because of it. So my nominee for Freshman of the Year is Al Pasholka. John was here for a minute and he left, but his nominee for Freshman of the Year was another Democrat, Maureen Stapleton, out of Detroit. She's been extremely active on a number of issues, particularly in regards to the city of Detroit with some of the struggles they've been going through, but she's been very active in getting her voice out there and letting it known what the folks out there are feeling on these particular issues. So he's been very impressed by the work that she's done. But we all agreed after we had our nominees, we actually had kind of a talk beforehand, that we all agreed that the Freshman of the Year for MERS will be Al Pasholka, and it's not because he was my nominee, but I think we agreed that being out in front of something so huge as the emergency manager legislation, being a freshman, just getting in and pushing this through is just something you don't really see very often. He showed a lot of grit in doing that and a lot of effect. Hey, it's not every day you get something that controversial through the legislature, and for his effectiveness on that, he will be our Freshman of the Year. All right. Also, joining us here today, an old friend, Tony Hansen from the Michigan United Conservation Clubs. Tony and I go way back. We were on staff together at the State News.
That's a long time ago.
That was a long time ago, dude. We were on the sports desk together.
Yeah,
was I your sports editor or not?
Jeez. I don't think you were. I think you did sports just after I went somewhere else.
Okay. Well, now you're doing hunting stuff for MUCC. And
right.
Let's first talk about the deer season. And, you know, one of the things that I never really realized when we were talking beforehand is how popular the whole deer issue is for your agency. Talk about that.
Yeah, deer hunting for a whole lot of people in the state of Michigan it's more than just, you know, a two-week time of year. It's a lifestyle. I mean, it's the way people identify themselves, and you know, we have 45,000 members. There's 780 some thousand people who will hunt during the gun part of the deer season. Almost a million people will buy a deer license. That's a whole lot of people doing one particular thing. It's very, very important. It's a very contentious issue. It's something that people in the state are very passionate about one way or the other. If they had a great season, they let you know. If they had a bad season, they certainly let you know that too.
Well, and let's talk about the bad season here. What has kind of been the upshot, excuse the pun, on the deer season so far? What are people saying?
It's been about as mixed a bag as I've probably ever seen. Usually you hear a lot of people from the northern lower and the upper peninsula in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years talking about how the deer numbers were down. They seem to be fairly satisfied with what they saw this year. And, you know, conversely, in southern Michigan, where we have, in theory, most of the deer, there's been an awful lot of discontent in southern Michigan. And it's kind of out of the blue. There was good deer numbers last year. People didn't really see anything unusual happening in the spring or the winter. We didn't have an exceptionally hard winter. But all of a sudden, here, you know, in the summer and as the early fall started coming, it seemed like the deer were disappearing, and I'm not exactly sure why, but we definitely did not have the type of season in southern Michigan that was predicted.
Well, and that's weird, because southern Michigan is usually where all the deer are, and so we're supposed to encourage people to hunt down here so we avoid car deer accidents. Maybe they got the memo.
It's really hard to say because, you know, I'm out there all the time. And in the spring, you have turkey season, so you get a pretty good indication if you're out turkey hunting how many deer are around, and you start to see the fawns that are being born. And there was no indication that there were fewer deer in the spring. We saw the deer in the spring. But as this, you know, the hunting season picked up, it would just seem like more and more people were saying, you know, we're not seeing deer. And it's not just, you know, we're seeing fewer deer. There was a lot of people that we talked with that interacted with us on our Facebook page or emailed us or whatever that just said, we saw no deer. I mean, almost none.
Maybe they were too loud.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the weather wasn't great, so that had something to do with it. And there was still a fair amount of corn standing, but I'm going to be really interested to see what the final numbers are. We still have a few more weeks of deer season left with the late season, so it could pick up, but right now it's not what we were expecting it would be.
What's the number of car deer accidents we're seeing?
Well, that's what's interesting. You know, around 10 years ago, the department really made efforts to start curbing the deer population down in southern Michigan, and about 62,000 car deer accidents reported by the state police in 2007. That's declined pretty steadily by about 3,000 to 5,000 a year. Last year we had 56,000. We're hearing reports that final numbers aren't going to be available until after January, but we're hearing reports that it could decline as much as 30 to 40% this year. So, again, I don't know what happened. I'm not saying that the deer are gone, but all the evidence that we have says there's going to be a big change in what was expected from this deer season and what actually happened.
Emily?
Yeah, I know there were a couple of changes this deer season. One of them, passed by the Natural Resources Commission, was the lift on deer baiting, mm-hmm. and or the lift on the ban, I guess, of right. deer baiting in most of the state. Can you talk a little bit about, do you think that affected the numbers? Were people able to attract more deer with the bait?
Well, if there's anything more contentious than deer hunting, it's deer baiting. So, you know, I have no idea. Do I think that baiting had an impact on the number of deer that were killed? I don't think that it did, especially in southern Michigan. Simple reason being, if you just look at one of the places I hunt, you know, it's about 350 acres. 200 acres of that is cash crops. I probably can't physically put out enough bait to compete with a 200-acre cornfield or a bean field. Now, once they cut the, you know, you certainly can make, you can manipulate deer movement a little bit, but I don't think baiting had a whole lot to do with it. And, you know, the other reason is I don't know that when it was banned last year, there was a whole lot less baiting going on than there is now that it's legal.
You mean people cheat out there, Tony?
Well, it's just, it's a really, really bad spot for the DNR. I mean, how do you enforce that even now that it's legal? How do you enforce that? You have a constantly shrinking budget. You're not getting any state funds. So what do you tell your conservation officer? Keep people safe. Stop people from poaching, or count the pellets, you know, in the corn pile and see if it's more than 2 gallons.
Yeah, that's another thing on enforceability is the amount of bait. I guess there's a limit on it now, which there wasn't a limit before the ban, was there?
Yeah, there's always, not always. In the last few years, there's been a 2 gallon limit, and it's supposed to be scattered around a certain segment. It's certainly enforceable if people are really, really cheating and physically taking truckloads, which they do, physical truckloads, and dumping it.
Wow.
That's a totally different thing than someone who's putting out 5 or 6 gallons. I don't know how an officer is going to say that's, yeah, it's scattered, but there's clearly more than 2 gallons there if it's only 3 to 5 gallons. Obviously, if it's a big honking truckload pile, that's not so hard.
Last thing I wanted to talk to you about before we let you go, Tony. Obviously, one of the big issues this year regarding hunting was this whole feral swine issue. Mm-hmm. And it got into the questions about these whole feral swine camps or farms and if hunting in these camps are really hunting. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, definitely. If there's a fence, it's not hunting. I mean, if there's a fence in the animal can't escape, it's not hunting, period.
Okay. So where have you guys been on this whole feral swine issue?
MECC is very supportive of declaring feral swine an invasive species and eradicating them. We will absolutely listen if you can show us regulations that the game farms can use that will keep pigs in. We haven't seen anything even in existence that will actually keep, you know, the pigs where they're supposed to be. If there are pigs in the state of Michigan, which there are, we can argue all day about how many there are, but there are. Where did they come from? They came from game farms, period. That's never been in question. So if you can devise a set of regulations that can keep the pigs behind the fences and that is not going to cost regular taxpayers like us that don't have game farms money, then we'll let you have them. But they haven't came up with that, so get rid of it.
Maybe we need the Department of Corrections to come in to set up one of their big fences around these things with the rolling wire.
Right.
And
right. It is expensive, and, you know, I'm a strong believer, you know that, in capitalism, and everybody should be free. But if you are going to take your business and cost me money and put the stuff that I love to do at risk, you got to pay for that. And if you can't, they need to be an invasive species.
All right, very good. Tony, thanks for joining us today, this week in the MERS Monday podcast. Also, thanks to Emily Lawler, Susan Demas, and Alicia Green. And also, a special thanks to the Michigan Press Association for sponsoring our podcast. And The Ghost is Dancing, the band now known as Powers, which is performing in Toronto this Friday. Emily, I would go, but my father-in-law is becoming Catholic on Friday, so that's where I'm going. Hey, don't give me these weird looks. Hey, it's a long process, okay?
Most people go the other direction.
Talk to Father Joe, okay? You've got his number. You call Father Joe and you ask him why it took so long. I don't know. Anyway, that's all for this week. Thanks for joining. I'm Kyle Mullen, and we'll talk to you next week.